Hello, everyone. Welcome to the bonus episode. And Dominic, we're continuing working our way through questions from the club members. And I think these questions are all absolutely excellent. I'd go so far as to say that the standard has measurably gone up.
What is coming?
No, not at all. No,
absolutely. No, the questions are great. They're really good.
So thank you all so much for your questions. We really value them and keeping both of us very much on our toes. So Dominic, I did see one for you, which I think is a great question. And I particularly want to know what your answer to it. And it's from S. Pilcher.
Okay.
And he asks, which revolution has had the greatest impact globally, the French or the American?
French, no question. The French Revolution and the wars that follow cost, I mean, how many lives? Hundreds of thousands? Millions? Mm-hmm. It's hard to know. No French Revolution, no Napoleon. And Napoleon is an absolutely transcendent historical figure. I mean, he is one of the, you know, top five historical figures.
He's a goat.
He's a goat. Yes, exactly. He is massive because he personifies the great man. His shadow hangs over the 19th century. The dictators of the 20th century, you know, they know about Napoleon. They see themselves in Napoleon's shadow. That's just not true of any of the early US presidents.
But wouldn't you also say that the ideology of the French Revolution is very influential on socialism, communism?
Yes, I would. The counter-argument, I suppose, would be to say it wouldn't so much, I think, be the actual political events of the American Revolution, but perhaps you might say the language of the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all men are created equal, all that stuff, that is then taken up by Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address, that becomes a kind of mantra, a very popular mantra for sort of left liberal movements, for protest movements, and so on and so forth. But I think the French Revolution, as a story, it reaches a level of almost mythic melodrama, don't you think? The mobs, the guillotines, the knitting women, all of that stuff, the executions of the aristocrats, the sense of the world being turned upside down, which obviously you get a little bit with the English Civil War. But I think the French Revolution is a, and the Russian Revolution, actually. I mean, I would, of the various revolutions, if I was ranking them in order, I would say French, followed by Russian, followed by American, followed by the Glorious Revolution. Now, the Glorious Revolution is massive for England.
Generally. S. Pilcher is also asking which civil war or revolution had the biggest impact in England, the civil war of the 1640s or the Glorious Revolution?
1640s, because the Glorious Revolution is an epilogue to the English Civil War, isn't it?
Okay.
Don't you think? What do you think?
Yes, I do. I do. So I agree with you on all of that. But one last question, which is mine.
Yeah.
Which revolution has had the biggest impact globally, the French Revolution or the Industrial Revolution?
Industrial Revolution.
And that's us, isn't it?
It is. So the
French boast about their revolutions, but we've had a bigger revolution.
We have had a bigger revolution. We are the winners. Because actually, I argued once in BBC History Magazine, asked people to nominate what they thought was the most single most important place in the world. And I said it was Iron Bridge in Shropshire.
Did you?
The birthplace of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, well, I think there's a very plausible case for...
Well, obviously, if the world does all burn up, Tom...
Yeah.
And we all die in kind of choked in smoke from the fumes from our own factories, then the Industrial Revolution will be, and Britain will be, the winner of world history. So
I always had a kind of a plot for a science fiction film in which the world is about to be destroyed by global warming or consequences of industrialization, and someone is sent back in time to assassinate the person who makes the Industrial Revolution happen. But the problem was I couldn't fix on, you know, James Watt or...
Yeah, there's too many people to...
There is. They'd have to do a lot of killing.
You would. Okay. I'm just going to start choosing questions. Previously, when we did the last week's episode and whatever, the week before, we were working our way very methodically through this list. But you've gone way off piece to start this episode with a...
That's a good question there, wasn't it?
It was a brilliant question. So I'm going to ask you two questions. Because there's two that I want to hear you opine on. One serious, one not so serious. So we'll start with the not so serious. It's from Jesse B. Jesse B says, what piece of clothing from swinging 60s London would you most or least like to wear?
We have our episode on fashion in the 60s coming up. And I seem to remember we actually discussed this, didn't we?
Well, we discussed which look we would go for, didn't we?
Yes.
Whether it's sort of Sergeant Pepper or...
But me personally, with my physique.
Yeah.
I think I would go for a mod look.
Yeah. So a suit or something.
Yeah, I think so. round dark glasses.
What would you least like to wear?
I don't really think I could carry off a mini dress.
Yeah, that's what I'd least like to see you wear.
I don't know. I've actually got quite good legs, so maybe I would.
Jeez. Well, you wanted to dress as Anne Boleyn for the Sunday Times photo shoot, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, you were very disappointed about that when you were cheated.
Well, I mean, you no chance to show your legs off with that. So actually, maybe I would have the legs. I mean, I'd look a bit odd, I think.
I think
you'd in a mini dress.
What would I'd most like to wear a PVC raincoat like Harold Wilson.
Would you?
Yeah, a plastic raincoat.
You can do that.
Yeah, I'd happily do that. And what would I least like to wear? I'd least like to wear John Lennon's glasses.
You see, I would like to wear them. So that's where we're different.
No, I think people look terrible in round glasses. So my second question to you, more serious, was from Mark Kay. And Mark Kay said, on a completely different note, why did Canute's conquest in 1016 not have the same impact on Anglo-Saxon England as William's conquest 50 years later in 1066? I love that question. I'm not going to spend it anymore. I just want to hear you answer it.
I mean, it's a very good question. And it relates to the fact of the cultures from which the respective conquerors are coming. So Canute is the king of Denmark. He is therefore representative of the Scandinavian culture that has been impacting on England for a couple of centuries. There's a sense in which there's a similarities in language between English and the various Scandinavian languages that has been eased by the evolution of a kind of pidgin. It's much, much simpler for an Anglo-Saxon nobleman to understand a Scandinavian nobleman than it is to speak French.
Yeah.
And there's a sense in which, over the course of the two centuries, a common culture has emerged that the North Sea is a kind of, has become a lake. The arrival of William, who, although like Canute, he is of Viking heritage, is very much a French duke. He is a dux. He is part of the fabric of the French culture that is in an incredibly expansive mood at the time of the conquest. And furthermore, is the embodiment of the revolutionary processes that are reverberating out from the Papal Revolution. And so, therefore, William is a much more, he's simultaneously both more foreign and unsettlingly revolutionary in his impact. And you know, the conquest of England is part of the same cycle of expansion that leads French conquerors and colonists to Sicily, provides the cutting edge in the Reconquista, and of course results in the Crusades. So I think that the answer is that William is a leader of a revolutionary process of change and Canute isn't.
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me. I mean, lots of Danes have pitched up in England, haven't they? I mean, there's been so much traffic between the two places. There must be Danish speakers in northeastern England when Canute arrives.
Well, there are in Oxford because there's a great massacre there.
Of course.
St. Brice's Day Massacre.
St. Brice's Day Massacre, yeah.
Which is part of what inspires the conquest.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, there are people in the north, aren't there, who support him, who welcome him. There are loads of people who ally themselves to him. There are what we might call collaborators if it was circumstances were different, local allies. So, I mean, that's probably true, I suppose, to some degree with the Normans, but far less so.
I've got a good question here from Katie Magdalen or Magdalen. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
And this is a question to add to Theo's massive backlog. He loves it. Don't worry about it. Possibly in common with many listeners, I'd long assumed I had fairly nerdy and niche interests, but the success of the rest of his history suggests otherwise, that even less well-trodden topics in history can have mass appeal across different ages, backgrounds, and genders. Do you think history is having a moment right now, and why might that be? Or is there something about history more than other subjects that is inherently universally engaging?
It's a good question. At its best, of course, history should be universally engaging. When I go and do my rants at schools, kind of primary schools and things, to get people interested in history. I'm just being self-deprecating.
What are you ranting about?
Just being self-deprecating, Tom. I go and give lovely, inspiring talks about Adventures in Time. No, I go and talk about Adventures in Time, talk about Alexander and Cleopatra and so on.
Oh, I see, right.
I always say to the children, there's no reason why anyone should not be interested in history, because history is about other people doing crazy and extraordinary things. And we all love to see that. So I think at its best, history should be inherently engaging. I think if it is told with an accent on character and story and so on, but there's no reason why it can't be slightly more cerebral and explaining and analyzing the processes of change and things. The funny thing about the question about is history having a moment is, of course, history degrees are in freefall in the United States and in Britain. Certainly, enrollment to study history is in decline. And that's a very sad thing if you want to see history, lots of people doing history in universities. I think one reason for that is actually, it's not much discussed, but it may be because people who are interested in history at the age of 18 or 19 feel they don't have to study history at university anymore because there are so many forums and vehicles outside academia that they can get into it. What do you think, Tom? Because there's a great panic among historians themselves who are watching their student enrollments fall and are worried about their jobs and about the survival of their departments and things. So it does seem odd that the rest is history has done well and attracted an audience at a time when generally the mood music around history is so gloomy.
So I'm just looking at the various categories that you get on podcasts on iTunes. You get news, comedy, society and culture, sport, health and fitness, arts, business, education, history, true crime, music, science, TV and film, kids and family, religion and spirituality, leisure, technology, government, fiction. So science is obviously an academic subject and history. I think that history is probably on that list because it is a source of stories.
Mm.
So lots of those subjects are narrative-based, whether it's true crime or sport or whatever. They're dealing with arcs, with narratives, with things that can be related as narratives. But of course, also there is analysis there. So politics requires analysis, science obviously requires analysis, and history perhaps is the intersection point of those two processes. Because we're not just telling, I mean, we do tell stories, but we're not just telling stories. We try and analyze them as well.
Yeah.
And I think that perhaps that's the sweet spot for a podcast. And it may be that podcasts provide a better opportunity for generalist people who don't want to do a history degree, say, than a university does. Maybe doing a history degree requires a level of commitment that, I mean, not maybe, I mean, clearly it requires a level of commitment that listening to a podcast doesn't.
Yeah.
And yet, I completely agree that history, I think, is inherently fascinating. I don't see how anyone could not be interested in history, because whatever the period, whatever the location, what it is revealing is the infinite number of ways that it is possible to be human.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with you, Tom. That's a very nice way of putting it. Let's have an archaeological question. Lulu Bazoo 222. I just went to York Minster and I visited the Undercroft Museum, which shows ruins from the earlier Roman and Viking settlements beneath the actual building. Which existing buildings would you love to excavate beneath, or do you think would hold the most interesting finds?
Oh, that's such a great question. I always think this when I go to the Mithraeum in London, which is on the street called the Woolbrook. And the Woolbrook was originally a river. It was a stream that separated the two hills in the city of London. And you get a sense there of the original geography and all of the stuff that has been found in the Mithraeum and preserved, all the organic material, the sandals, the writing material and things from the Roman period has been preserved because the river has prevented them from rotting away. And when you go down into the depths and you realize how far down human settlement goes in London, that is 2,000 years worth of archaeological sediment that has built up. It's very, very difficult to dig anything in London and not come across something. But imagine digging a metro or something in Rome or Athens. I mean, that's a nightmare.
They probably have much. I mean, the trouble with digging in London is there's all kinds of regulations now, right? That slows everything down. Having stared at an archaeological dig in the center of Thessaloniki, so there was some church and there were people digging underneath the church, and it was just extraordinary. They had these massive drills, kind of just randomly drilling and bulldozing bits of stuff. I kind of thought, yeah, the Greek regulations are probably not quite tight as they are in London.
But there's a place that's even more vivid than that, which is San Clemente in Rome. Have you been to that?
No, I don't think so.
So it's a church just beyond the Colosseum.
Oh, I know where that is. No, I haven't been. Yes.
And it's, I think it's a Baroque church built on the site of a medieval church.
Yeah.
And you can go down and down and down, and right at the bottom, there's a street from the first century AD. And it's like going down through paleontological layers of sediment.
Yeah.
Here's a mammoth, here's a dinosaur, here's a early fish or whatever. And you feel that going down, you get a sense of the depth of it all. And you feel that across Rome, there must be so many locations like that, that if you could just dig down, you would find all this stuff. But of course, that would involve destroying so much.
Yes.
To be an archaeologist is, in a sense, to destroy. And that's why I think the most vivid evocation of the frustration, the fascination of that is in, I think it's the beginning of Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, where he compares the human mind to a map of Rome in which all the various buildings from different periods coexist, so that you have Romulus's hut and you have the medieval Lateran and you have fascist buildings or whatever. They all coexist at the same time.
Yeah.
It's such a kind of brilliant metaphor for how the human mind works.
Just going back to that, what you're saying about San Clemente in Rome, that reminds me of Naples in the Centro Storico in Naples. I can't remember whether it's on the long street Spaccanapoli or Via Tribunali. There are places where you can go and there are literally layers, street layers. So you go into a church, then you go down and there's the Roman street, and then you go down a level further and there's the Greek street before it. And you get a sense of the extraordinary layering of history in somewhere that has been inhabited for so long. The other place that occurs to me is in Istanbul. I think I mentioned this before in the podcast.
You did, yeah. About the restaurant, the cafe.
Yeah, Palatium, I think it's called, where you go down and there is the ruins of the Imperial Palace. It gets completely unregulated. You can roam around with your torch, just basically in a beer garden. And presumably, I would guess, the ruins of the palace must be, I mean, if that's just one bit of it, there must be a lot more under the central tourist district of Istanbul, kind of behind Hagia Sophia, and this sort of warren of streets where there's lots of pizza restaurants and backpacker hostels and stuff. Again, they'll never do it. You can't dig up every archaeological site, can you?
But I realize that neither of us have actually... No, you have. I haven't answered Lulu's question. So there are two sites that I think would be most interesting.
Yeah.
One of them is the Kaaba in Mecca. Fascinating.
I don't think you're ever going to get permission for that, Tom.
Of course not. It would be fascinating to see what lay beneath that, to try and get a sense of the historical emergence of Mecca derived from the archaeology rather than from the perhaps slightly fantastical accounts that we have in the sources. And the other, of course, is Temple Mount in Jerusalem. I mean, who knows what lies beneath the Dome of the Rock. And it's so sensitive, of course, that no one can ever dig there, which is a matter of some upset to particularly Zionists who are very keen on digging it up. But I don't think that will happen.
Oh, really? Why? What do they think they're going to find?
Well, they think they'll find the remains of the temple.
Oh, right. Yeah, fair enough.
So it's probably the single most politically sensitive archaeological site in the world.
Yeah.
And I would include on that list Ayodhya in India, which was the site of a mosque that Hindu nationalists claim had been originally a temple to Rama.
Yes.
It's the birthplace of Rama, the great hero. So religiously sensitive archaeological sites are always going to be the most interesting to dig, but for that reason are why no one will ever be allowed to dig there.
Okay, let's have another question from Jeffrey Cheesty. This is one, a good one for both of us. Following on from our series on Irish history and on the American Revolution, do you think we underestimate how much of a factor anti-Catholicism has been in British and American politics? And given that Tony Blair wasn't keen on admitting his conversion to Catholicism while he was Prime Minister, is it still a factor? So I've got lots to say about this, but Tom, you go first.
I think it's a massive, massively important factor in British history, certainly since the Reformation.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it is so important to recognize how important Protestant Christianity has been. And the fact that it's, you know, that sense has now faded doesn't mean that you shouldn't make the effort to try and see politics, culture, whatever, through Protestant eyes when you're looking at so much official British culture over the past centuries.
Yeah, we definitely underestimated. I know that some people actually commented to us after the American Revolution episodes how they were really interested when Adam Smith made his points about the Quebec Act and what was seen as the British government's disgraceful toleration of the French Canadians' Catholicism and the fears of a kind of Catholic conspiracy, which are absolutely from the sort of playbook of the 1630s and 1640s. So that anti-Catholic kind of panic, a huge factor. I mean, this isn't something that British historians have spotted. I mean, lots of American historians have written about this in the build-up to the American Revolution, but it's something that doesn't necessarily get a lot of airtime in the kind of popular understanding, I think, of the American Revolution. Anti-Catholicism was a huge force in 19th century American politics. So the Republican Party, anti-slavery party, was also an anti-Catholic party and had picked up a lot of support from people who had previously been members of, let's say, the Know Nothings Party, which was a kind of anti-Catholic party. The progressive movement of the early 20th century in America was often quite anti-Catholic. The Ku Klux Klan was anti-Catholic. Prohibition was anti-Catholic. As late as 1960, when John F. Kennedy runs for president, he's the first Catholic president, and he has to go out of his way and give a very, very famous landmark speech saying, I will not owe the Pope my allegiance. You know, we have separation of church and state. You are not betraying the American Republic by voting for a Catholic candidate. In fact, in 1928, when Al Smith from New York had been the first Catholic nominated by a major party as president, there was definite backlash vote against that. So that persisted as a force in America for a long time. In Britain, I think by the 20th century, it's very understated, but I think there are elements of it still there. So there are some historians who think that, for example, in the 1950s, when the European common market started, opposition was particularly strong in the Labour Party. And there are some historians who say, well, one reason for this is that a lot of kind of working class, patriotic kind of Labour politicians had an instinctive dislike of Catholics and Catholicism. So Ernest Bevin, one of my favorite British public servant statesmen who was foreign secretary, Clement Attlee's foreign secretary, he'd come from a very poor background in the West Country, illegitimate, people couldn't read, all that kind of thing. Bevin was said to, when he was on trains and nuns got on the train, he would kind of shudder and be very uncomfortable and would mutter about black crows and all this kind of thing. And actually, there is a definite sense in the 1950s and 1960s that people on the British left thought of the European Union as it became as basically a confederation of Catholic Christian Democrat parties.
Ian Paisley did, I think, didn't he?
Ian Paisley did, exactly. And we all laugh at Ian Paisley now and say, oh, ha ha, what a ridiculously anti-Diluvian thing to say. But there would be an awful lot of people actually in Britain who they wouldn't have maybe been able to articulate it as Ian Paisley did. And they certainly would have articulated it in the same 17th century terms. But instinctively, they would have thought there's something a bit corrupt, a bit crooked. And actually, that idea of kind of continental corruption was so important in Euroscepticism in Britain.
Well, I think there's also another way in which hostility to Catholicism very much lives on into the present, and that's in the particularly militant form of atheism.
Yes. Philip Pullman,
Richard Dawkins, when they condemn religion, they are drawing on very ancient, very traditional Protestant polemics against Catholics.
Yes.
The whole idea of there being a war between religion and science emerges from very radical Protestant traditions, particularly in America, but also in Britain, where Protestant anti-Catholic tropes are kind of bled of their overt Protestantism, but are clearly deriving from that. And so you wouldn't get people like Ian Paisley framing their anti-Catholicism in overtly Protestant terms anymore. That would be seen as unacceptable. But you can still draw on the tropes if you kind of bundle in your criticisms of the whole of religion, but actually your main target is Catholicism. And that was very, very evident, I think, when Pope Benedict made his visit to Britain. And so much of the, I remember seeing kind of campaigners outside waving placards, and, you know, they might as well have been the streets of Northern Ireland in the 50s.
Yeah. I mean, actually, so what's really interesting is that his Dark Materials, the Philip Pullman book series that was then made into a drama by the BBC, we've been watching it recently, catching up on it. And I can't remember how on earth I fell down this rabbit hole, but I ended up reading the reviews of the series in the Irish Times.
Right.
And the Irish Times reviews were notably much less complimentary than the British newspaper reviews, because as the Irish Times' reviewer, Ed Power, said, the villains look and sound as though they've come straight from the Vatican rather than from tea with the Archbishop,
yes,
of Canterbury.
Yes.
And he says, the trilogy reads less like my first book of atheism than as a potshot at Catholicism.
Yes, I think, and of course, the intellectual cladding is provided by Milton, who was a militant anti-Catholic.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually, isn't it? So I think, in some ways, actually, we should do Milton at some point, Tom.
Yes, definitely. I love Milton.
And actually, the Philip Pullman phenomenon is an interesting historical phenomenon because he's very much of a particular moment, isn't he, those books?
Well, I think the history of the war, the supposed war between religion and science, is a very interesting topic.
Yeah, Very good. The claims about Galileo, for example.
Absolutely.
Theo is telling us we have to stop talking.
Okay.
As always, whenever we record these, every week we record these, Theo is so deluged with editing because we've recorded too many other episodes, Tom.
He's saying, please wrap.
Please wrap.
Please.
Yeah, begging us to stop.
So we will now wrap.
Maybe the listeners are begging us to stop too.
They may be.
So on that bombshell, we will say goodbye to you and we'll be back next time with more answers to your questions. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.